What's happening, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to the Crash Bang Boom Drumming Podcast today. Whether you're a drummer, artist, creative type, musician, whatever you want to label yourself as, welcome. And if this is your first time, well, then an extra welcome. Today's guest is drummer Isaac Falk of Denver, Colorado's Blood Incantation. He and I caught up when the band flew in for two sold-out shows at Brooklyn's own St. Vitus Bar, where we got to talk about the many different processes they opted to record with on their newest record, Hidden History of the Human Race, which included using analog gear, no click tracks, and a whole lot more. And super cool talking to him about that because I had no shortage of questions and listening to the record and trying to ingest it. Definitely got some epic shit happening. We also talked about prog rock influences, the origins of the band, stories of growing up and touring Colorado, and a whole lot more. And I can say, as someone who's now seen the band live, you definitely got to check them out. It really was an impressive damn show and a breath of fresh air in what can be sometimes a stagnant world of death metal, so definitely go see them if they come to a town near you. Crash Bang Boom Podcast can be found on iTunes Podcast, my SoundCloud and YouTube pages, Stitcher, Luminary, Google Play, Podbean, and more. If you like what you hear, feel free to check out any of the previous 170-plus episodes. Give me a like, a subscription, a positive rating, and or a glowing review, and or all the above. The support is appreciated. If you're looking to release vinyl for your project, go on over to NewOrleansRecordPress.com to look at the many vinyl coloring, packaging, mastering, electroplating, lacquer cutting, and more options. And you can use that handy little real-time quote generator to tally it all up and know what you're getting into. They also print 12 and 7-inch records in 150 and 180-gram variants. So check them out, and that's NewOrleansRecordPress.com. So without further ado, here we go. Isaac Falk of Blood Incantation. Newest record, Hidden History of the Human Race, is out. And if they come through a town near you, definitely go see them. The atmospheric, proggy death metal shred fest is real. Crash, bang, boom.
Crowds go mad with joy.
I'm here with Isaac Falk of the one and only Blood Incantation out of Denver, Colorado. What's happening, dude?
Doing great, man. Yeah, just here in New York City.
Coming into New York, flying in, flying out for two nights at St. Vitus, both sold out. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thanks. It's one of our favorite places to play, for sure. So,
how many times have you all played here previously, I guess?
We've been to New York, I'm going to say, this has got to be like the sixth or seventh time, I think.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, y'all been a band maybe 11 years or so now?
Yeah. We've been a band since 2011. So okay. About coming up on 9 years total.
Seven trips to New York in 9 years is that's pretty impressive.
Well, we didn't start playing shows really until 2015. So,
wow. Yeah. So y'all hit it hard in 5 years.
Yep.
Right on. Damn, man. Well, congrats on the new record, Hidden History of the Human Race.
Yeah, correct.
I got it all right. I had an acronym in my head, which was Triple HR, and I was like, if I have that, then I won't fuck it up.
There you go.
Now, however, I will let you say the title of the last song on the record, which almost takes as long to say as the actual duration of the song, and that song's about 20 fucking minutes.
Yeah, it's that's a long one for us, and we're going to play it tonight. So,
nice. Yeah. What's the title again?
Awakening from the Dream of Existence to the Multidimensional Nature of Our Reality, Mirror of the Soul.
See, now that is one, for instance, that I would have fucked up.
Yeah.
At least you knew it. I was kind of curious if you could nail it, and you nailed it, so congrats.
Yeah. That's actually the song on the record that I wrote, so.
Nice.
Yeah, the guitar parts as well as the drum stuff.
A lot of epic ins and outs and atmospheric stuff, and then all of it. I mean, obviously, of course, the cross of 19-ish minutes or whatever, you got to venture into some cool territory there.
Yeah, that much like a lot of the record, but that song specifically is, you know, kind of our death metal take on classic prog bands
right.
like Yes or, you know, King like, Crimson or something.
Absolutely, so. I'm a major fan of all of them.
Yep.
Close to the Edge in particular
exactly.
is one of those records, like the song Close to the Edge, that has those different...
long form.
Yeah.
Same with the Gates of Delirium on Relayers.
Right. Yep. Relayers, another one that a lot of people look over. There's some wild shit going on in that.
Yep.
I'm a major fan, a couple of maybe the Alan White records, but of course I'm always going to be partial
Bruford,
to Bill
yeah,
Bruford.
Of course,
right?
Of course.
How can you not be?
Yeah, of course.
And then it's like, oh, if it wasn't cool enough that he played with Yes, oh, listen how killer he is in King Crimson. Oh shit, there's that.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's one of my all-time top influences for sure. So.
Absolutely, and I mean, you want to talk about a pretty epic record and Fragile, and really all of them. But I just try to wrap my head around recording such a masterpiece to tape.
Exactly.
And so many layers. And, I mean, that was a band of geniuses. I mean, there was...
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it was just outrageous.
A lot of those bands at that time, but I think definitely specifically Yes and King Crimson were bands, and Gentle Giant, too, were bands that were really just about finding the best musicians around who were versed in stuff like classical music, but also jazz and other stuff, and incorporating that into the rock music at the time, which... You know, obviously Prague died in the late 70s because it was, like, considered super pretentious. But, like, that's what I love about it. It's just completely insane musicianship. So, yeah, we try to kind of, like, carry that over into all the death metal stuff we like. So.
Right on. That makes absolute sense. Yeah, the Prague element of it all, right?
Yeah.
Well, going back to y'all playing these two nights, y'all flew in and, I mean, backlined gear, the whole thing. Everything's been working out, and I imagine easier than driving and unloading and dealing with gear and setting up and all that shit. This is relatively easy, I would say.
Yeah, we've gotten to the point now where we really, I think, have honed in how to make these experiences as good as possible, figuring out the merch, like, way ahead of time. And flying in the night before playing instead of flying in the day of.
Oh, that's dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah, so, so we've really done a good job of requesting that stuff from the promoters. So it was St. Vitus specifically, the owners, that reached out to us and wanted us to do these shows. So we thought it was going to be a great opportunity, and then we just kind of said, like, we'll play the shows, but we want to have kind of the pick of the bands to play. So
nice.
Last night we had Dysrhythmia and Artificial Brain. Tonight we'll have Funeral Leech and Ruin Lust. And those are two kind of distinctly different genres.
Like, I'm a fan of mixing that up.
Yeah, so last night was more of, like, the weirder night, proggier. Tonight's more of the old school style, so, and we're gonna do two different sets as well. So
nice. Are you playing the super long song, your song, both nights? Or
correct? Yeah, we're playing Hidden History of the Human Race in its entirety both nights.
Awesome.
But last night we did Star Spawn in its entirety.
Nice.
And then tonight we're gonna be doing the EP Interdimensional Extinction. So
holy moly, dude.
Yeah.
How long does that make for a set?
So I think last night's set was about 65 minutes.
Right on.
Yeah.
At least you can breathe a little bit. It's not nonstop blast beats.
Correct. Yeah, there are, you know, intentionally so. But, I mean, also, we're just a band that likes dynamics.
Exactly.
So, you know, we have, like, Funeral Doom parts and clean, proggy sections and times where I can kind of, chill out a little bit, which is nice. And we have our, like, ambient interludes and stuff, too, so... Yeah.
Well, going back to this record that y'all recently just put out, and that's killer that y'all playing it in its entirety. Y'all doing it chronologically?
So we're doing it as it is on the record, yeah.
Right on. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about the process of recording that, because it's always interesting when I talk to people that are kind of immersed in this world of more tech side of, like, heavy music. Because I think with really any genre, I think it can become a little monotonous, and especially, I guess, with sort of the death metal world where things can become so overly produced and ultimately can kind of become sterile, I think, at times.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that your album doesn't have that, so I'm curious as to the process in which y'all recorded it and how that ultimately, I think, distinguishes y'all from other bands.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, because that's definitely what we're going for, so I appreciate that. And, I mean, I would just start off by saying, like, you know, I'm a fan of older music, generally speaking, so I really like, especially death metal from about the late 80s to the mid-90s.
Of course.
That sound is great production-wise and musically, but then also, like we were talking about before, about progressive rock and all that stuff.
Yeah.
There's something about the sound of analog tape that just... has a warmth to it that you just don't really get otherwise.
And that's something, that's what y'all recorded to on this.
Exactly, yeah. So 2-inch tape, that's how we recorded Star Spawn on the last record. And then on this new record, we approached it similarly. The main difference is that we used a sample trigger for the kick drum for the new record, but we didn't for the last one.
Gotcha.
So,
do you notice the distinction in the kick sound a little bit in having that sample added? I mean, it will add that.
It does, yeah. And we had to really tweak it a bit because the one that we used while we were recording misfired a bunch. So we had to go in and kind of do it digitally. So but basically what we did is we took... the drums from the tape and then put them into Pro Tools.
Right.
And then, you know, found each hit and then, you know, put that into the recording.
There's a lot of hits.
Then recorded that back into the tape.
Wow.
From the computer. So,
wow.
So it was actually, that part of the new record was really time consuming. We didn't do that on the last one.
Fuck yeah, it was.
But it does make it so that those really fast parts are a lot more audible, whereas
right.
like on the last record, when I was going, you know, really fast, like 30-second notes, it kind of gets lost, you know? And it just becomes a kind of like a rumble in the back, which is cool, but...
It's the slippery slope of things, and
yeah.
it's one of the things that I'm glad that you brought up the triggers thing. That's yet another conversation that I've had with, for instance, like Dave from Psychroptic and John Long from Origin, and they definitely play triggers, obviously. But the slippery slope of it is the faster it gets, you do need a sort of really distinctive sound in there. I think sometimes you just need it to be balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if it's so forward, then everything sounds papery and clicky.
Right. Yeah, that's my main thing is finding the right sample.
Yes.
First of all, and then also mixing it well. And
yeah.
that's also part of what I think is good about the analog tape is that it actually really warms out that
yeah.
clicky sound. And we mixed it together with the actual kick drum sound. So
right.
it's not just the trigger.
Right, right, right.
So, yeah, I'm actually, as far as the way that the drums sound, I'm really happy with how they turned out on the new record.
Yeah.
Because I think they do sound, like, natural. And we didn't play to a click track, so
wow.
it doesn't have that really, really sterile sound like
mm-hmm.
you're talking about, where a lot of these bands, and not to knock anyone, you know, in particular, like, if that's how you want to record, like, you know, do whatever you want.
It becomes so overly gridded at times that it
exactly.
almost sounds superhuman.
You might as well have a drum machine, honestly.
And some guys can play that style naturally. John
totally,
Lodge is
yeah.
absolutely
oh,
one
yeah,
of the guys.
Definitely.
You'd swear he was a fucking machine.
Totally.
But and I fully respect that, but I like the balance that we're talking about right here.
I mean, yeah, it's just a matter of style and taste and, like, what you want. You know, like, there are these bands... like, you know, Necrophagist and stuff, where it's like, yeah, it's like super impressive, like
right.
technically, but it doesn't inspire me in the same way that, you know, Martin Lopez from like Opeth, you know,
right.
had like just a style and a feel that's not necessarily the most technical, but has like a groove and a vibe. And
yeah.
I think that's, for me, that's really what I'm kind of leading towards more. And same like what we were talking about with Bill Bruford and stuff.
Of course.
People like that who were playing, they had metronomes in the studio and stuff for sure, but you know, what you played is what you played, and
right.
you know, there was some editing that could be done, but you know, you can't just go in and quantize every hit.
Sure.
So, you know, when you listen to those records, like, it has that human quality, which
yeah.
That's really what we're going for this band, because I think that we come across best when we're in our lives scenario.
Uh-huh.
So, trying to capture that as closely as possible on tape is the goal.
Right. I work in video, so time code is kind of the thing that binds everything, as is a click track oftentimes in recording scenarios. But when you in the absence of that, you do lose the ability to then just splice in, you know, take to take and say, oh, I like this. I like the first, second, and third of this. We'll do the fourth. We'll do it. Not so much. So, but that puts a different pressure on you and your preparation going into it, knowing I kind of have to commit to this and nail it.
Correct, yeah. So the new album was very challenging for that exact reason.
Fuck yeah.
The last record was difficult, but the new album, I mean, the material is just harder to play. So
yeah.
We really spent a lot of time before recording. We practiced for about every day for multiple hours for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Leading up to the studio. And then even when we got to the studio, it was still very difficult. And there was like at least two of the songs that I think we did probably, I mean, not full takes, but we had to run through the song like close to 10, 15 times.
Oof.
Before we got like the one that I was happy with. And I'm really hard on myself. I'm like a perfectionist, and there's still stuff on the record that I'm not 100% happy with.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we couldn't just keep doing it, right? Because
yeah.
if we got one that was good enough, that was solid, you know, all the way through, I mean, it's on tape. It's not to a click, so we can't really punch stuff in and out, especially for drums, because if you try to punch, even if I was on time, if you punch it in and out on the tape, you can hear the tape being
mm-hmm.
in and out of the machine.
That edit, yeah.
So,
yeah, yeah.
So you can hear it in the cymbals. It's like makes this like washy sound.
That's always what, yep.
So yeah, so there were a couple times where I think we tried to do, or what you can do is you record it on another piece of tape and try to literally cut the tape and
right.
and put it into the tape itself. Tried that a couple times, but at the end of the day, we just had to do the whole take again. And so,
fucking
you
A.
know, I got pretty exhausted. It took like 2 whole days to get all of them. And by then I was really worn out. I got kind of sick also on like
oh shit
the first day.
Oh no.
Where I was feeling really like weak and just like getting a fever or something.
Oh my
just,
God.
So we took a little break and then I came back and yeah, so it was really rough, but what's on there is on there. It's, you know, it's out there now and people seem to dig it, so.
Yeah. And I mean, it's hard for you also to be objective about it without some time removed from listening back to it, right? And I mean,
totally.
There's so many micro things that you would hear. That's one of the things that I have to remind myself in those scenarios. I
yep.
know that you may tell yourself that you hear it, unless it's so blatant, so many people won't hear it. Maybe
right.
a drummer here somewhere might hear it, but fuck, you can't cater to one drummer somewhere that might have heard it.
Exactly.
Like, come on now.
And it makes me go back to old albums that I've listened to a million times.
Yeah.
And then I hear like
you hear
little
mistakes.
Things, and I'm like, yeah, because it's just a person, and you know,
exactly.
it's not a drum machine,
yeah.
you know, and so there is a little given flow and of the timing and stuff, especially when you're not playing to a click track. So
exactly.
Yeah.
So you were able to knock out the drum tracks for this record in 2 days.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Awesome, dude.
I think we started recording the day before that, but the one take we only got like one or two takes of one song, I think, and. He had to recalibrate the tape the next day, so he had to erase
shit.
The take that I had done, which is, of course, your worst nightmare.
Yes.
As a musician, you're like, that take that I thought was super good is just gone now.
Oh.
So we just restarted, yeah, and then it was about 2 whole days, and we were recording all live. I was in a isolation booth, and
yeah.
they were outside, so we could all see each other
yeah.
through the window, and... A lot of the basic guitar tracks are also live from those
really, and
you
were
well.
Able to do that.
And then they did some overdubs and all the solos and stuff like that on top of that.
Right. Then I guess obviously you have vocals, you have everything else that you've got to knock out with that. So it's
yeah.
always a process, but
yeah, we did vocals, timpani,
nice.
Synth,
awesome,
and all this stuff. Yeah.
Nice, man. One other thing that I'll say about, especially in, I guess, the tape world and doing multiple takes, especially when you're trying to knock out like an entire album in X amount of days or whatever,
right.
is that talk about diminishing returns at a certain point. For me, my best take, even if there's mistakes, is always about the first, second, or third. I rarely ever, and I'm going on 30 years of playing, get better as more and more takes. I get more inside my head, you know?
That's definitely true. The more in your head about it that you are, the worse it's going to get. Yeah, so it's tough to ride that line
yep.
of being like, I really want it to be better, but can I even do it better,
right?
Right? So that's the question. And also, this is something that I've talked to with some other musicians, just the idea of recording before going out and touring the album. So often, I'll tour an album for a couple years, and then I play it 100 times better than it's on the record, right? And it's also I come up with some new things here and there,
like,
new
ah,
fills
shit.
And
yep.
stuff. So then, yeah, it's like, well, the record is there as this, you know, monument to that time, that
yep.
time and place, and but you just got to kind of move on and let it breathe. And that's why we put out like a live EP at the end of 2018, Vitrification of Blood, parts 1 and 2.
Nice.
Played in succession, so it's like 20 minutes of music. Recorded here at St. Vitus, actually.
Awesome.
And I think having those live recordings kind of helps me feel good about stuff because I'm like, okay, now I have like an even better version of it that people can hear. So
yeah. One last thing that I'll say about Yes and analog recording and epic recordings in general. I don't know if you know this guy, Rick Beato, on YouTube that breaks down. He does this thing, What Makes That Song Great.
Oh, cool.
He's got multiple episodes of it, but one in particular, he does a song off of Fragile, and he has isolated tracks. So you can hear all the vocals, the bass, the organ, the drums, the percussion, everything isolated.
Wow.
And then if you thought you had a sense of how layered it was to begin with, wait until you start hearing isolated tracks on that record. And
oh,
then,
yeah.
then remind yourself once again, this is going to tape.
Yeah.
Wow. So no shortage of drum and talk, obviously. Why the drums for you in the first place? And do you remember your first kit that you got?
Yeah. So kind of a funny series of events. I started off as a bassist when I was around 12 because my dad is a guitarist and a drummer. And so I was like, well, I want to be a musician, but I'm not going to be like my dad, right? So that was like
there you go.
My mentality. He had a drum set around, and so I just started playing on his drum set. And eventually he was like, well, I'm going to get you your own drum set.
Two drum sets in the house now.
He had his own like kind of studio place that him and his friend had built where he was doing audio recording and stuff. At our house, then he got me a set of like D drums.
Uh-huh.
Really crappy,
yep.
You know, cheap set. But that's what I started on and had it right in my room. And I just started off when I was about 14, just started playing every day. I would come home from school and just play. And
what were you playing along to at the time?
So the stuff that got me really into playing drums, I remember specifically it was Nick Barker from Dima Borgir, actually.
Okay. So you started off with, like, pretty intense music as that's interesting.
Yeah, I was getting into metal when I was in middle school. And then when I was around 14, I started getting into black and death metal and stuff. Specifically, I heard Dima Borgir, and it was the album Puritanical Euphoric Misanthropia. Puritania, specifically this drum beat on that, was one of the ones that I was like, I have to learn how to play this. Like that was like one of the things that stuck out. And I would go to, before I had my own drum set, I would go to the music store in town and they had like an electric kit and I would just like, you know, play on it until they told me to leave. Basically.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
And then I got a kit and I started just playing along. But my biggest thing as a kid was that I wanted to play my own music. I didn't really want to learn other people's music. So I also started learning guitar, and so I started them both at the same time. And so I basically just started off, my dad had some studio equipment at the house as well, and he just started helping me, and we just started recording just random stuff where I was doing all the instruments. So
that's awesome.
Bass guitar and drums, you know, pretty rudimentary stuff, but it was like kind of like black metal stuff.
Right on. What'd your dad think about your ventures into this music?
He was tepidly supportive. he was always very supportive, but every time that I would like start listening to a band that was a little more musical, I guess, like, you know, when I was listening to like really harsh death metal and black metal, he would be kind of like, I don't know about this.
What are you listening to, son?
Yeah, but then when I got into Opeth and stuff, he was really more accepting, you know. He'd be like, oh, that sounds like Kansas or something.
Sure.
Or, you know, it sounds like bands that I like.
Talk about a band that embraced both classic rock and prog rock and Opeth.
Exactly.
So that probably connected some dots for him.
Oh, yeah. And when I was growing up, he was always listening to prog stuff like King Crimson and Emerson, Lake & Palmer and
stuff. Right
on. So, I mean, I grew up with, you know, 21st Century Schizoid Man playing and stuff. So I was always really inspired by that type of stuff. Yeah, so he was super supportive and still is to this day. And having that ability to just play music at home and get that kind of perspective on recording and all that stuff early on was really helpful.
Yeah.
And then when I was around 16, my parents decided to get me some drum lessons. So
nice.
I got drum lessons from this guy named Christian Teal.
Is this in Denver or Denver area?
In Boulder, actually. I grew up
right
in,
on. Boulder's awesome.
Yeah, Boulder, yeah.
I haven't been there in a really long time, like over 20 years. But it was awesome 20 years
it's
ago.
It's not as awesome as it was. Yeah, no. Growing
that
up there was awesome.
That seems to be the growing trend with most cities.
Which is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing is as cool as it was, right? That's all. That's what nostalgia tells us.
Right.
But also, Boulder has priced out everybody now.
That's my understanding.
You know, they have like the Google campuses there now and CU and all this stuff. You know, it's to buy a house there is like almost bare minimum $1 million.
Wow.
You know? So I don't live there anymore. But when I was growing up there, there's my drum teacher, Christian Teal. He's the drummer for he plays in the E-Town band, which is like, they do all kinds of stuff. Having a drum teacher that was not metal oriented, but he knew how to play metal stuff.
That's cool.
I mean, he was the first person that was like, hey, you should check out Moving Pictures by Rush, you know, and yeah. stuff.
Rest in peace, Neil Peart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, R.I.P. and Sean Reinert.
Sure. Yeah, I know, for exactly, yeah, going yeah. back to, yeah, Deaf and Cynic, right?
But yeah, he was super influential on getting my chops up on stuff like jazz and stuff
right
like
on.
That, so.
Yeah, it's important. I never really took any lessons with any kind of metal guys. I think in Louisiana, and especially like around New Orleans and in New Orleans where I took lessons, that wasn't as much of a thing, but definitely there was the jazz thing. And I'm glad in hindsight that I was able to like catch up with people that were more immersed in the jazz and like Afro-Cuban Latin world, and it definitely gave me a different perspective and kind of pushed me to do some different things, and it's manifested itself throughout the years in different ways, but I'm really glad that I was able to be exposed to that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not as accomplished in that arena as I would, you know, kind of want. So I've always thought of myself as like a metal drummer who wishes he was a jazz drummer. So that's where I kind of like venture out of my comfort zone is where I like to do stuff like that. But
right.
Yeah, it was nice to have a little bit of that training in at an early age.
Yeah. You grew up in Boulder. I'm thinking like the last time I was there, it might have been 25 years ago. It was in the 90s.
Yeah.
So
that
it was a long
must
time
have been
ago.
When I was growing up then, yeah.
Oh my God, man! I love it out there. My mother lived in like four different areas. I think she lived in Alamosa and Crestone, and unfortunately Greeley, Colorado, which is insane.
Oh yeah, that's the worst. Yeah.
and then one other one in Colorado, and then I played in bands touring out of New Orleans, and we would do like all the ski resort towns. So then we would hit Aspen and Telluride and Steamboat Springs and all that. So Colorado, strangely enough, is one of those states that I've seen like an incredible amount of. And it's beautiful, man. I've mountain biked there. I've gone, you know, I've done like whitewater rafting there and like all kinds of shit that someone who grew up in the swamps of Louisiana was definitely not going to be doing. So when my mother moved there, I was like, this is incredible.
Totally.
There's so much shit to do here.
Well,
I am a fan.
That is the biggest thing now is there's just too many people that have figured that out, that there's all this cool stuff to do there. Plus, we legalized weed and all that stuff. So,
boy, that changed Denver.
I mean, obviously, there's lots of good things about it, for sure. But the population growth in Colorado has just been insane for the last few years. So
that's what I've heard.
So yeah, it's a different place than it was. It's not as chill, I would say. And even the mountains are just so crazy now because everyone is wanting to go skiing and all that stuff. So
it wasn't like that necessarily 20 plus years ago.
Right.
It doesn't seem that long ago, but apparently enough for the tectonic shift that happened in the last probably decade or so, I would say.
Definitely. Starting in 2014.
You want to hear my crazy tour story?
Yeah,
from Colorado,
sure.
Since we're talking about Colorado. So I went out and ended up eating. We played this kind of bizarre show and ended up eating some mushrooms. And
like you do.
Just
in
out of
Colorado.
A bag. Yeah. And it was in this... We were staying in these like little like cottages, but it was really close to a train that would come barreling around and like screeching throughout the night. And I remember we went up to the top of a mountain at some point near where we were playing, and I ended up walking home, tripping balls pretty good, tried to walk down the side of like this mountain to the road to not have to walk down the other parts of it, ended up like tumbling down it, and I woke up the next morning in my bunk, and I was covered in grape jelly, and my watch was missing, and I was like, what the fuck happened last night? Where did my watch go? Why am I covered in grape jelly? I'm fucking sticky. Like, I feel like
I definitely
ate mushrooms and drank entirely too much beer and smoked too much weed and everything. And then so I was like, I'm gonna go see if I can find my watch. So I walked back up the road, and I saw like what looked like some divots in the side of the kind of mountain where it led back down to the road, and I saw something shining, and I was like, oh my God, is that my watch? And I walked back up, traced my steps, and I found my fucking watch.
Wow.
Yeah, tripped balls, covered in grape jelly, lost the watch, found it the next
day. Ever find out why you were covered in grape jelly?
I think at some point I might have tried to make some a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but was just the coordination was a little shot.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't see peanut butter. It's possibly that I started with the grape jelly.
And then it went out of control and...
Maybe lost control. Either that or some crazy Colorado chick had some fun with me and covered me in grape jelly, and I don't recall.
You never know, man.
I mean, fuck, who knows?
Who knows? The mysteries of the world, man.
Exactly. It happened to me.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously Colorado is known for its psychedelic kind of... I mean, Boulder was like a psychedelic haven back in the day. And, you know, growing up, I was... You know, my parents are total hippies. So, yeah, I was exposed to a lot of that stuff early on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I fully support the legalization of all psychedelics.
100%.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had no shortage of good times when they definitely were not legal and still had one hell of a time.
Exactly, yeah.
Other than that's the only time that I ever did it in the mountains. And otherwise, it was like in Louisiana. And that presents its own bizarro.
Yeah, that's its own
My
world.
Parents owned camps literally like 30-minute boat rides out into the swamps of Louisiana.
Oh.
So we'd like go eat mushrooms out there and
watch
like heat, lightning, storms. There's alligators everywhere and fucking cypress trees. And like we're in a boat and fucking.
That'd be wild.
It's fucking. Trust
well,
me, it was.
My dad and my stepmom both grew up in Louisiana.
That's crazy.
And, back in the 60s. So.
No shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you my said dad was playing in bands down there.
No
back
way.
In the late 60s and 70s.
You say your dad's originally from New Orleans.
So he was born in New Orleans and then grew up in Abbeville.
Okay.
Yeah, a little town near Lafayette.
Yeah. Southwest. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yep.
It's funny. Those are two different worlds. I mean, Southeast, you have your own thing, the proximity of New Orleans. But New Orleans is also autonomous, similar to Austin, in that once you leave New Orleans, you realize it's still a bunch of rednecks everywhere.
New Orleans is, honestly, it's its own world in the whole country. Like there's really
maybe
nothing
globally.
I've traveled a lot. There's really nowhere like New Orleans.
100%.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be there in a few days for Mardi Gras.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, maybe I'll eat some mushrooms.
There you go.
Oh,
hell
fuck,
yeah.
Man.
That would be a time.
Yes, it would.
Some easy rider.
Yeah, exactly. No shortage of sensory overload. Oh my god, man. So we've kind of gone full circle more or less. At which point did the band start? Like, how did everyone find each other?
Yeah, so Paul, the vocalist and lead guitarist, both me and him met each other in 2011. We were both playing in other bands. I was playing guitar in a band called Stoic Dissension, which was like a Black Doom band. And he was playing guitar in a band called Velnius, also kind of like a Black Doom band.
Gotcha.
And played a show together at this DIY venue called Blastomat, and immediately kind of hit it off. And then I met him again when he was working at this pizza place in Boulder called Pizza Calore on Pearl Street, and saw him again. He was like, "Hey man, like check out these tapes that I have. Let's listen to some tapes real quick."
Nice.
And then he was like, "You know, if you want to get together and play guitar in a funeral doom band, let's do it." And I was like, "Yeah, for sure." So we started Abysmal Dimensions together, and that featured some other guys playing bass and drums, Andrew from Velnius and this guy James playing bass. And we were doing that. We did a couple practices, and then I was in a different band as well at the time called Sentimani, which was kind of my like high school band.
Okay.
So I was, you know, around this time I was like 21.
Wow.
When I met him and showed it. I played drums in Sentimani and I showed him a recording that we had just done, and he was just kind of blown away. He was like, "You play drums? I had no idea. And you can play like fast double bass. Like, do you want to start a death metal band?" And I was like, "Okay, sure. Let's do it." And so Abysmal Dimensions kind of went on hold, and we just started jamming more stuff like that, and that's how, I mean, he already had the idea. He kind of, like, came up with the logo, just kind of everything all at once, and we just started jamming, just me and him, and then the whole thing was just trying to find someone else to play guitar and finding a bassist and stuff. So the next year, he met Morris at a party, and they talked about Death and Iron Maiden and stuff, and found out he played guitar, and so he joined shortly after. We jammed with him, and it was like instantly clicked. And then for a while we didn't have a bassist because there was just no one that we really knew in town that we wanted. You know, we wanted someone like Steve DiGiorgio or something, or you know, just some crazy like fusiony, maybe jazz influenced but death metal bassist who could play fretless or something. Like that was kind of like our dream goal, you know. So we actually ended up having Damon Good, who plays in a band called Stargazer. He lives in Australia, but he did the bass tracks for our first EP, just kind of remotely.
Yeah.
And so that's, we played like three shows that were just the three of us.
Yeah, just
no
trio,
bass.
Double guitar, drum trio.
Yeah, yeah. So we did three shows like that that were just like local, really small shows.
Yeah.
Just because we wanted to, you know, do something. Meanwhile, all of our other bands were really active at the time. And and then finally, in 2015, Jeff, who was playing in Velnius with Paul at the time, both Paul and Jeff left Vilnius, and we were like, do you want to be in Blood Incantation? Because he was a great bassist, and he had a fretless bass, and we were like,
oh,
you want to try
points.
It out? Yeah. Yeah. And so he learned the EP songs and then learned some of the new songs we were working on, which later became Starspawn. And then we did our first tour with him.
Nice.
And then after that, we recorded the first record. So it was pretty much from 2011 to 2015 was really, you know, us trying to figure out what to do with the band and how to get it. Really, at some points, like, wondering if anything at all was going to happen with it, just because we were all so busy. And then now it being, our main band. So, yeah, it's really shifted.
Wow. And I know, like, this is kind of a weekend warrior fly in, fly out, but for longer trips, how do you sustain yourself when you're not touring and going back to still be able to live and make happen, you know?
Yeah, within the last couple of years, we've actually been able to be more sustainable as a band.
That's awesome. Congrats.
Not putting our own money into it as much and really being able to, you know, survive off of it a bit. But while I'm at home, I'm a substitute teacher.
Cool.
So I actually got my degree to be a teacher, and then the touring kind of took off and haven't really had time to have a full-time gig. But subbing is kind of like really easy. I can work whenever I want and no requirement of me being home for any extended period of time. So I just put in the times that I'm gone for tour, and it's really easy. So
nice. You found a way to make it work.
Exactly. Yeah.
Hell yeah, man. That can be such a make or break thing. So if you have a flexible gig that, you know, is there when you need it, that's the ideal scenario for someone who's touring, obviously.
Yeah. And that's really, I mean, I've really kind of set it up where it is kind of just the perfect situation.
Awesome,
so,
man.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, congrats on that. Congrats on the new record. Congrats on selling out Vitus this weekend. And I guess good luck going forward, man.
Yeah, thank you so much. And it was a pleasure doing the podcast with you.
Absolutely, buddy. All right, everybody. Thanks for checking out the episode and hope you enjoyed it. Definitely a good time talking to Isaac and picking his brain about being a band out of Colorado and the prog influences and musical household and mushroom stories and just other outrageous, bizarro, Colorado-related stories in general. We'll catch y'all on the next one. Crash, bang, boom.